Well, good evening. As you can see, we're going to be looking at the 12 disciples. Now, Jesus had a number of people that followed him, that traveled with him, that would have called him their teacher and their master. But of all of these people, he picked 12 of those to be part of his inner circle. He selected 12 men to be part of his inner circle, and with these 12 men, he would spend a lot of time. He would spend 3.5 years teaching them and training them so that they would be able to continue the job that he had started when he was gone. History tells us that almost all of these men would die in the course of the work that Jesus had left for them. These men would risk their lives and they would lose their lives in spreading the gospel message throughout the world. But because of their courage and because of their hard work, that gospel message was spread throughout the known world at that time. So if you're in the position of Jesus, and you know that in 3.5 years you're going to be gone, and you have to select people to carry on your work, how would you go about selecting these men? How do you select people for a job like this? You see, it's really important that you get the right people for the job. Imagine you're the CEO of a new company, a new business, and you're picking people to take that business global. You know that there's going to be intense competition, there's going to be a lot of problems, people are going to have to deal with different cultures, different languages, different environments. You know that these people at times will risk their lives, they'll face death in the course of the work that you are picking them for. How would you go about picking them? What would you look for? Well, you may have seen this letter, and I apologize for the poor font. I was trying to get it all on one page, so I'm going to read it to you. It's a little cute little letter that portrays the selection of the disciples from the perspective of a modern-day career consultant. It starts off, it's to Jesus, son of Joseph, the woodcrafter carpenter shop in Nazareth, from the Jordan Management Consultants, Jerusalem. Thank you for submitting the resumes of the 12 men you have picked for management positions in your new organization. All of them have now taken our battery of tests. We've not only run the results through our computer, but also arranged personal interviews for each of them with our psychologist and vocational aptitude consultant. It is the staff opinion that most of your nominees are lacking in background, education, and vocational aptitude for the type of enterprise you are undertaking. They do not have the team concept. We would recommend that you continue your search for persons of experience with management ability and proven capabilities. Simon Peter is emotionally unstable and given to fits of temper. Andrew has absolutely no qualities of leadership. The two brothers, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, place personal interest above company loyalty. Thomas demonstrates a questioning attitude that would tend to undermine morale. We feel that it is our duty to tell you that Matthew has been blacklisted by the Greater Jerusalem Better Business Bureau. James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon definitely have radical leanings. They registered a high score on the manic depressive scale. One of the candidates, however, shows great potential. He is a man of ability and resourcefulness, meets people well, and has a keen business mind, and has contacts in high places. He is highly motivated, ambitious, and responsible. We recommend Judas Iscariot as your controller and right-hand man. All of the other profiles are self-explanatory. Wish you every success in your new venture. Well, I thought that was cute. But the point that comes across from this is that the men that Jesus selected were not obvious choices. If I was picking a group of men to go out and turn the world upside down, I wouldn't have picked these men. I wouldn't have picked the men that Jesus chose. Consider for a moment the men he picked. He picked a group of poor, uneducated fishermen. He picked a tax collector. A profession at that time was known for lying and cheating and corruption. He picked a zealot. Zealots were freedom fighters. They militantly opposed the Roman rulership. You know, in today's world, we'd probably call them terrorists. Jesus even picked a man who he knew was going to be a thief, was going to steal from his money bag, and who would eventually betray him to the Jewish leaders. Almost all of these men were from the backwater areas of Galilee. So what was Jesus thinking when he picked these men? Couldn't he come up with a better group of men than these? Was this all he could Was this the only choice he had? You know, from today's standards and from reading that little letter, we would say that these men were totally unsuitable for the job at hand. Well, how did Jesus select these men? We're given a little piece of information in the Gospel of Luke, which I thought was helpful. In Luke chapter 6, we read about the selection of these men. We're given a fact that only the Gospel of Luke records for us. Luke chapter 6 and verse 12. And it came to pass in those days that he went out into a mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called unto him his disciples, and of them he chose 12, whom also he named apostles, Simon, whom he also named Peter and Andrew, and goes on through the list of the disciples. Now I suppose you could say that Jesus was pretty tired when he picked these disciples because he'd spend all night awake in prayer to God. Now this last week, Christy and I, we drove back from my grandparents in California, and we left at 11 a.m. on Monday, and we caught the 11 a.m. ferry on Tuesday. And after being up most of the night driving back, if it was me, I would have been in no position to make any critical decisions, any important decisions. That just would have been a bad time for me. But here's Jesus. He's up all night, and then he makes some of the most crucial decisions in his ministry in picking the 12 men that are going to carry on his work. You can see he would have been pretty tired. But I don't think this affected his decision. You see, I think what Jesus was praying about the night before he picked these men is he was praying to God and asking for God's guidance and help, and helping him pick the right men for the job, and helping him to choose the right people. So if that's the case, why did Jesus choose these men? Well, to answer this question, I think you have to realize that all we've talked about so far is from a totally wrong perspective as far as God is concerned. You see, God really doesn't care about resumes. He doesn't care about where you're from. He doesn't really care about what you've done in the past, particularly when the things that you've done in the past have been through your own resources, your own ability, your own skill, your own cunning. God is totally interested in what you can accomplish through him and through his strength. He's interested in what you can accomplish when you're motivated by him, when you submit your life to him, and you ask for his help, and you ask him to direct you. As God pointed out to Samuel when he picked David, God doesn't look on the outward appearance, he looks on the heart. For this reason, I think it's useful to take a closer look at the men that Jesus picked. Just to start off with, I want to just look at the listings of the men he picked. And if you look through the Gospels in Acts, you'll find that there are actually four lists of the disciples. John doesn't actually list the 12 disciples. He refers to them as being 12 disciples, and he mentions 9 of them. But he doesn't actually give us a list. Now, if you look down through the list of names, you'll see that there's a slight variation in the order that these names appear. And although I don't think the order is terribly important, I think it does give us some information. At the top of the list, the first four are always Peter and Andrew and James and John. And Andrew is always listed either second or fourth. I think this tells us something about Andrew. It tells us that during the course of Jesus' ministry, he experienced a drop in position. He started off at number 2, and he found himself number 4. We know if you read through the Gospels, you'll find that of the 12 disciples, there was a select inner group of 3 that was composed of Peter, James, and John. Andrew dropped out of this group. He wasn't a part of it later on. After these first 4, you find that Philip is always listed next, followed by Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthew. In John's Gospel, Bartholomew is never mentioned. And in all the other Gospels, Nathanael is never mentioned. And because of this, some have speculated that Bartholomew had another name called Nathanael. And that might make sense, because Bartholomew means Bar, means son, and Tholomew might have been his father, so son of Tholomew. And that might have been a surname, and his given name might have been Nathanael. Also, if you look in the account, you find in John 1 that it was Philip who brought Nathanael to Jesus, and you'll find in the listings of the names that Philip is listed next to Bartholomew in the Gospel accounts. The other interesting point to notice is that In Matthew's gospel, you see that Thomas and Matthew are switched around, whereas in the other two gospels, it's Matthew before Thomas. And that might just be a little support to the fact that Matthew wrote the gospel of Matthew, and he was showing a little bit of humility in putting Thomas before him in his own gospel. After these three, we have James, son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Canaanite. And of these three, we know virtually nothing other than the listing of their names. Finally, we have Judas Iscariot. It seems that all of these men, other than Judas Iscariot, was from the Galilee region. Iscariot means the man of Kerioth, which was a region in Judea. These were the 12 men that Jesus selected. I want to now have a closer look at two of these 12 disciples. I'm going to look at Peter and Andrew particularly. But what I think is neat is as you look into these 12 disciples, you'll find that they're very different people. They all have different characters, different personalities. They had different skills, different abilities. I think that's interesting and helpful because you see God calls lots of different people. And we're all different. And we all have different abilities, and we all have different skills. And God has called all of us. And just because someone has one skill and ability doesn't put them above someone else. We're all important, and we're all needed. Jesus needed all of these men. He was preparing all of these men for the work he had in store for them. So I want to start off with looking at Peter. Peter's a pretty logical choice because he's the number one disciple listed on all of these lists. And if you read through the gospel accounts, you'll find the most information about Peter. He was part of the inner group of three with James and John. But what was Peter really like? If you look at in the Gospels, you have to make a character profile of him. What would you come up with? Well, when you read about Peter, at least when I read about him, it seemed to me that he was the type of person who was a little bit larger than life. When he walked into the room, everybody noticed that he'd walked in. He was a leader to whom people gravitated. He was loud, he wasn't afraid to ask questions, even if they might be stupid questions. When the others were hesitant to say something, Peter wasn't. He just spoke up. He was willing to stick his neck out. He was willing to stick his neck out, realizing that, you know what, he might be wrong, he might look stupid, he might get it chopped off, but that's just the way he was. He was intensely loyal to Jesus. If Jesus said to jump, he would ask how high on the way up. Look at a few examples of Peter and what he was like. If you turn with me to Matthew chapter 15, we have an example of Peter willing to speak up when the other disciples were a little bit hesitant. Jesus had just told a parable, which it seems that none of the disciples had understood. And they all realized, well, each individual realized they didn't understand this, but none of them were willing to say anything about it, to try to figure out what Jesus really meant. Probably because they were scared of looking foolish. But here's Peter, Matthew chapter 15, verse 15. Then answered Peter and said unto him, declare unto us this parable. And Jesus said, are ye also yet without understanding? Now that's a tough thing. You know, you ask a question and the person responds, huh, don't you understand this? Haven't you been with me a long time? Don't you understand what I'm saying? But that was Peter. He wasn't afraid to stick his neck out and ask the stupid question. To find out what Jesus was saying. He was confident enough in himself that he could do that. We find also that Peter was decisive. He was very sure of himself, sure of what he thought. We have an example of that in Matthew chapter 16. Reading at verse 13. It says, there when Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? And they said, some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, and others Jeremias, or one of the prophets. He saith unto them, but whom say ye that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter was decisive. He knew what he thought, and he was prepared to state it, put it on the line. This is who he thought Jesus was. He believed that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God. We also have examples of Peter's leadership ability. He was a leader. And the other disciples seemed to follow his lead, for better or for worse. An example of this was in Matthew chapter 26. And this was right after the Last Supper, it says there in Matthew 26 and verse 33, Peter answered and said unto him, though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet will I never be offended. Jesus said unto him, verily I say unto thee, that this night before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. Peter said unto him, though I should die with thee, yet will I not deny thee. Likewise also said all the disciples. No, all the disciples might not have really felt that way, but here is Peter standing up and saying, no, this is what I believe. I'm willing to die for you. And all the other disciples said, well, that sounds like a good thing to say right now. And they went along with Peter. They followed his lead and his example. We have another example of his leadership in John chapter 21. John 21 is right after the resurrection. And Jesus has been appearing to the disciples, but he wasn't around at this time. And they weren't quite sure what to do with themselves, it seems. John 21, verse 1, it says, after these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And on this wise showed he himself. There were together Simon Peter and Thomas called Didymus and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples. Simon Peter saith unto them, I go a-fishing. They said unto him, we also go with thee. And they went forth and entered into a ship immediately, and that night they caught nothing. So they're all waiting around, not sure what to do with themselves, and Peter's finally like, all right, I'm going to go fishing. Who's coming with me? And they all decided that sounded like a pretty good idea, and they went with him. That was Peter. He was a leader. The other disciples followed his lead. We also see Peter's dedication and his loyalty to Jesus, his desire to be with him. And there's, a neat little example of this in Matthew chapter 14, a situation where Peter got out of a boat to walk on a rough sea to go to Jesus. Matthew 14, verse 24. It says, but the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went in unto them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it is a spirit. And they cried out for fear. But straightway Jesus spake unto them, saying, be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it be thou, bid me come unto thee on the water. And he said, come. And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said unto him, O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? And when they were come into the ship, the wind ceased. Then they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying, of a truth, thou art the Son of God. I think I like this incident, because I think we see some of the best of Peter and also some of the worst of Peter. See, there's a huge storm raging around, and all the other disciples are buried in this boat, trying to keep it from sinking, worried that they are going to sink, and they're all going to drown. And they see Jesus walking on the water towards them. And Peter's reaction is, Lord, if you bid me to come, I'll walk over to you. Now, I'm pretty sure Peter understood the law of gravity and the fact that water, when it's in its liquid form, doesn't usually support people, and that if you step out into it, you will sink. But he still said that. He still said, Lord, if you bid me to come, I will walk out on the water to you. I think that's interesting. Peter was willing to stick his neck out to risk the impossible if Jesus said to come. He's willing to believe that if Jesus said to come to him, then it was possible for him to come to Jesus. And he got out of the boat. None of the other disciples had that level of faith or confidence. You know, if it was me, I don't think I would have gotten out of that boat, because you see, I believe there is a law of gravity, and I believe that when you step into water, you sink in water. And unless you can swim really well, you're in trouble. And if you're stepping out of a boat into water when there's a huge storm around, well, that's a really bad time to test your understanding of the law of gravity and the way water works. But that was Peter. You know, he said, if you bid me to come, I'll come to you. I know it's impossible. I know this shouldn't work, But if you say to do it, I'll do it, because I trust you and I believe that the impossible isn't impossible for you. But there's another side to this, in that we see there was a weakness in Peter. I think he had a slight overestimation of his own ability and his own confidence. And he put himself in a situation where he became overwhelmed by the situation. And he got out and he started walking on the water and he realized, you know what, this is impossible. This isn't something I can do. And he got overwhelmed by the wind and the waves and he started to sink. He thought, what in the world am I doing out here walking on water? I can't walk on water. And he was afraid and he sank. He lost sight of the fact that it wasn't because of him that he was able to walk on the water. It was because of God that he was able to walk on the water. God was making this happen. You see, I think Peter had a little bit too much confidence in himself and his loyalty to Jesus and his own ability. And when he got into the situation, he lost a little bit of that. And he thought about himself and thought, I'm doing this, and I can't do this. And he became afraid and he sank. This weakness in Peter comes up a little bit later on when a microscope was placed on him. And that was at the Last Supper. We read one version of it earlier. I want to go to another version in Luke chapter 22. In Luke 22, we read, starting in verse 31, the disciples, along with Jesus, had just finished the supper, and they're about to leave. And at verse 31, we read, "And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not. When thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. And he said unto him, Lord, I am ready to go with thee both into prison and to death. And he said, I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me." Now, I'm sure Peter didn't understand why Jesus was saying this to him. I'm sure he was a bit upset about this. One, Jesus is referring to him by the name Simon. This was Peter's old name. This was the name he had before he met Jesus. This was before Jesus had changed his name to Peter, Peter the Rock. Why was Jesus calling him by his old name, the name he had before Jesus' ministry? And then Jesus is questioning his loyalty, questioning his support for Jesus. And Peter was upset by this, because he was very confident in his own ability and his loyalty for Jesus. We have another account of this, and we find that this happens a little bit later in Mark chapter 14, where Jesus says a similar thing a second time. And this is after they have left the room where they had the Last Supper. Mark chapter 14, starting at verse 26. "And when they had sung a hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. And Jesus saith unto them, All ye shall be offended because of me this night, for it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered. But after that I am risen, I will go before you into Galilee. But Peter said unto him, Although all shall be offended, yet will not I. And Jesus saith unto him, Verily I say unto thee, that this day, even this night, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. But he spake the more vehemently, If I should die with thee, I will not deny thee in any wise. Likewise also said they all." Now Jesus comes a second time and says the exact same thing to Peter. And Peter is more upset and he replies vehemently and says, I will not do this. I would rather die than to abandon you, to deny you. Peter was very confident in himself that this wouldn't happen. He wasn't like this. He was loyal to Jesus. There's no way he was going to leave Jesus. And when the soldiers came to take Jesus away, Peter decided to make good on his promise. And he pulled out his sword and he took a rather vicious swing that just missed the head of one of the high priest's servants. What was he doing? Well, he was making good on his promise to Jesus that he would die before he would abandon Jesus. So let's put this on today's terms. It's the police are about to close in on Jesus to arrest him, and Peter pulls out a gun and takes a wild shot. Today, if you pull a gun on a police officer, you are asking to die. They sometimes refer to this as police-assisted suicide. Pulling out a sword and swinging wildly when a bunch of Roman soldiers are around was very much the same thing. It was asking to die. And that's what Peter did. He decided, I'm going to die in this situation. I'm going to prove Jesus wrong. I'm willing to die, and here I go. And then Peter lost control of the circumstance, and Jesus took control. And he healed Malchus's ear. And Peter suddenly found out that he wasn't dead, he was still alive, and he didn't know what to do, and he lost his nerve, and he ran. He ran like everyone else. But he must have felt a little bit bad. He must have felt a little bit ashamed. And he came back, and he followed Jesus at a distance. He went to watch what was going on. And from this point on, it was all downhill for Peter. He got in over his head. And gone was his confidence, and gone was his loyalty, and he just didn't know what to do. Well, what was the problem? Well, I think the problem was that Peter was confident in his own ability, in his loyalty to Jesus. He was confident in himself. This is who I am. The problem is that sometimes time and circumstances places us in situations where we simply can't do it by ourselves, where our own confidence, our own loyalty breaks down. What we have to realize is that loyalty and confidence based upon God is what we need to develop. We can't do it sometimes, but God can. God can always do it. And God can do it through us if we will but learn to sit back and trust Him and rely on Him. And that's what Peter, I think, learned out of this incident. He learned that, you know what, confidence in myself isn't enough. I have to trust in God and rely on Him to get me through these circumstances when I'm out of my league. Why don't I move to another disciple, this time Peter's brother Andrew. And compared to Peter, we're told very little about Andrew. Well, we are told a few things. We're told that he was Peter's brother. We're told that in Mark 1 that Peter and Andrew lived together in the same house. We're told in Matthew 4 that he was a partner in a fishing business with Peter. Despite these two men being brothers, despite them living in very close contact, they were very different people. But we're told actually an interesting little fact about Andrew in the Gospel of John. We're told that Andrew was one of the very first of Jesus' disciples. We read that in John chapter 1, starting at verse 35. It says, again the next day, after John stood, and two of his disciples, and looking upon Jesus as he walked, he saith, Behold, the Lamb of God. And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. Then Jesus turned and saw them following, and saith unto them, What seek ye? They said unto him, Rabbi, which is to say, being interpreted, Master, where dwellest thou? He saith unto them, Come and see. And they came and saw where he dwelt, and abode with him that day, for it was about the tenth hour. One of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first findeth his own brother Simon, and saith unto him, We have found the Messiah, which is being interpreted, the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. And when Jesus beheld him, he said, Thou art Simon, the son of Jonah. Thou shalt be called Cephas, which is by interpretation a stone. Andrew was one of the very first of Jesus' disciples, one of the first men that decided that he was going to follow Jesus. He wanted to find out more about who Jesus was. He spent the day with Jesus. And after spending the day with Jesus, you can see his excitement. He realizes that here is the Messiah. This is the Messiah they've been waiting for. And what's the first thing he do? He runs off to go find his brother Simon. I think that's interesting. That's the first thing he did, that he ran off to go find his brother Simon. The reason is because Andrew was evidently in Simon Peter's shadow. It's interesting, if you look at the verses where Andrew appears, he appears in 12 verses, the name Andrew. And 7 of these verses read something like this. Matthew 4, Peter and Andrew, his brother. Matthew 10, The first Simon is called Peter, and Andrew his brother. Mark 1, Andrew, the brother of Simon. Mark 1, verse 29, the house of Simon and Andrew. Luke 6, Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew his brother. John 1, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. John 6, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. When you think about Andrew, when people thought about Andrew, who he was, invariably they thought about him as Simon Peter's brother. He was constantly referred to this in this way in the gospel accounts. Andrew was Simon Peter's brother. He was sort of overshadowed by his big, louder brother. He was a little bit in the shadow of Peter. They didn't really remember who Andrew was. They remembered, oh, Andrew, that's Simon Peter's brother. In light of this, it's interesting that the first thing Andrew does after spending a day with Jesus is he runs off to tell his brother, Simon Peter, about Jesus. I think that's interesting because sometimes if you've been overshadowed by someone else, sometimes if you've sort of always been the person to be in the corner and your big brother has always gotten most of the attention, and you have an opportunity to finally be in the limelight, to finally, you know, be in a better position than your brother, to be the one who found the Messiah, you know, he might try to take advantage of this and enjoy it for a little bit. Now, here's Andrew. Andrew's the one who found Jesus, not Peter. It was Andrew this time who found Jesus first. But no, the first thing he does is run off to find his brother and to bring him to Jesus, knowing that as soon as he does that, that Simon Peter is going to grab the limelight. Simon Peter's the one who's going to get the attention. It seems that's what happened. As we saw earlier, when in the listing of the names of the disciples, Andrew gradually drops off from second to fourth. Peter and James and John grabbed all of the attention, and there was Andrew at four. But that was okay with Andrew. He learned to deal with that. That was fine with him. That's the way it was, and he learned to deal with that. And I think that's really commendable for Andrew. See, Andrew didn't have the flair or the charisma that Peter had, but he was willing to accept that and to move on and try to find his place and his role. It's interesting, we don't have that many verses about Andrew, but in the verses that we have, one thing comes out, and that is he is always bringing people to Jesus. John 1, we read how he brought his brother Peter to Jesus. John 6, you can read how in the feeding of the 5,000, he brought the lad with the barley loaves and the fishes. And in John 12, a group of Gentiles came to Philip and said, we want to see Jesus. And Philip wasn't quite sure what to do, so he came to Andrew and said, what should we do about this? And Andrew said, oh, let's go tell Jesus. Let's go bring these men to Jesus. That was Andrew. In the few verses that we have about him, we find him bringing people to Jesus. He obviously was approachable. Obviously people could talk to him. And although he might not have the most charisma, he was willing to bring these people to Jesus. In the incident with the feeding of the 5,000, I just want to look at that a little bit more closely, because I think this incident tells us quite a lot about Andrew and the faith that he had. We can read about this in Mark chapter 6. Mark chapter 6, starting to read at verse 35. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him and said, this is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away, that they may go into the country round about and into the villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. He answered and said unto them, give ye them to eat. And they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 penny worth of bread and give them to eat? He said unto them, how many loaves have ye? Go and see. And when they knew, they say, 5 and 2 fishes. He commanded them to make all sit down by companies upon the green grass. So, Jesus was proposing to his disciples that here are all these tired and hungry people. We need to provide them with some food. And the disciples looked at what Jesus was proposing to them and said, this is impossible. Look, 200 penny worth of bread, which was evidently more than they had in their treasury, wasn't enough to feed all these people. What were they going to do? There simply wasn't enough money to feed these people. They're in a desert place, and even if they did have enough money, how are they going to get that food there? And Jesus simply said, sent them off and said, go ahead, go see what resources you can find. Let's see what we can do. In the Gospel of John, John 6 tells us that of all the disciples that went off to look for some resources, it was Andrew who was the one who came back with something. He came back with this lad who had 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes. And he brings this lad back to Jesus with this little bit of food and says, here's what we have, but what are these among so many? I think that this little incident tells us an awful lot about Andrew. See, all the disciples went out looking for some food, looking for some resources so that they might somehow feed all of these people. I don't think they went off with much hope of getting anything. But only one of them came back with something. That was Andrew. He came back with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And to feed 5,000 people, that's, well, pretty useless. So useless that you might have asked the question, well, what's the point in bringing this back? What's the point? You might as well tally a list and see what you can find, but, you know, why bother bringing back 5 loaves and 2 fishes? I mean, to feed 5,000 people, that's useless. But he brought it back anyway. And he presented it to Jesus and said, you know, I realize this isn't enough to feed all these people. What is this among so many people? But he brought it anyway. See, Jesus had presented to them a task that was totally impossible. They couldn't possibly feed all these people. They couldn't do it. There's no way they could feed these people. But Andrew brought back to Jesus what he could find. This was all he could find, so that's what he brought. And he left the rest up to Jesus. It's almost as if he was saying, look, I know this isn't good enough. I know this isn't going to feed all these people, but here's what I could do. And Jesus turned that little bit of food into enough to feed 5,000 people and have leftovers. You see, I think all the other disciples were a bit overwhelmed by this task. They didn't understand what they were supposed to do. They thought it was impossible. And they were overwhelmed. And they didn't do anything. And here was Andrew. And he thought, you know what, it is an overwhelming task. We can't possibly solve this problem, but you know what? We might not be able to, but maybe Jesus can. Let's bring what we can to him. See what he can do with it. He realized that he couldn't do it. The other disciples couldn't do it. But maybe Jesus could. Maybe Jesus could accomplish the impossible if we'll just do our best and bring what we can. And I think that's a really important lesson for all of us, because you see, God often asks us to do things that we might think are impossible, that there's no way we can possibly do what he's asked us. But what he's really doing is asking us to get started, to do our best, to do what we can, even if it may seem to be just a small amount, some little thing, even if we think it might not accomplish very much. And if we do that, God will take what we offer, and God will accomplish the impossible through us. It won't be us that's doing it. It will be God who is doing it. I think Andrew began to realize that, and I think we can see that in the faith he showed in this situation.